in the depths of this very, very hot Texas summer, nobody in their right mind would wish for a return to mid-February of last year, when millions of households tried to survive a record-setting cold snap that froze almost the entire state and pushed the Texas energy grid to the breaking point. A year and a half later, is our access to electricity in extreme weather any more secure? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you lived through the Great Texas Freeze of 2021 and you were one of those who lost electricity or had your pipes burst, I'm guessing you will never forget it. My guest's work may ensure that people in a position to make the changes necessary to prevent a repeat event also don't forget. Mose Bushell is a reporter at KUT and host of the podcast The Disconnect, Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout, which is out now with a second season. Mose, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
The first episode this season reminds us that while for many people who suffered during those terrible days early last year when the grid went down, for some people, the sorrows of this are still a daily hardship. Tell us about the Shaw family.
Yeah. Our first episode, we profile the Shaws, who are a family who lost their mother in the freeze, in the blackout of 2021. We kind of wanted to do this to remind people of what the stakes are in part, and to remind people that while some of us have been able to kind of pick up and move on, others simply cannot. The Shaws they live here in Austin. They live in North Austin, and they, like millions of others, lost power during the blackout. They were kind of hunkered down in their house with their two elderly parents. And their mother, Manjula, is among those who died in the blackout. Her official cause of death was eventually listed as hypothermia. And worth noting as well, she's among the people that the state has officially recognized as having lost their lives as a result of the winter storm and blackout, which is something else that we get into in this episode, the way that the state has gone about trying to account for those deaths and some of the criticism surrounding that method.
So what kinds of, excuse the cold phrasing, but this is how statisticians talk about it, what kinds of excess deaths from the storm and the power outage might have been left off those official counts?
Hundreds. This is something that kind of started coming out soon after the blackout. There were media reports. I know BuzzFeed did a very influential one that compared the way the state of Texas is officially recognizing deaths in the blackout to the number of people who, statistically speaking, would not have been expected to die in that same time frame, if this makes sense. We've heard a lot about excess mortality in the context of COVID-19, but essentially what it is you can take a look at the numbers of people who have passed away within a certain time, and you can compare that to what you would expect statistically, and you can say, oh my goodness, hundreds more people actually died in this time than we would have expected. There's a huge disconnect, if you will, between the number of people that the state recognizes as having died as a result of the storm and the hundreds more lives that were lost in that time. And you know, what journalists, including us, have been asking is, why don't we do a deeper dive into this? If indeed hundreds more people died during the blackout than we would expect, even if it didn't have to do with the blackout, which I would find very surprising, we would want to know why that was the case. But thus far, there's been no official effort to look into that.
And this really is on Texas and its system, right? Because nearby states that were also very, very cold for extended amounts of time during that same storm did not see the same rate of excess deaths during that time.
Yeah, there's a statistician based in Israel who's done some research on this early work. He calls it preliminary, but I interview him. His name's Ariel Karlinsky in this episode, and he says that according to what he's looked at, these excess mortality rates were not the same in places that may have experienced similar weather, but where the energy system held up. Now, if that's the case, it's very difficult to imagine that it has anything to do with something other than the blackout.
And just to be really clear here, Mrs. Shaw's family was keeping close tabs on her during the storm, the way we were all advised to do with older folks. They didn't realize she was in danger right away. Hypothermia can be really tricky to spot if you're not a professional, can it?
Absolutely, yeah. And we talked about that with them, and it was difficult for them. She appeared responsive. She was an older woman who had been recovering from hip surgery. So, she was in a weakened state going into this, but they did not know until it was, and they did not know for quite a while that she may have been in this kind of trouble. Eventually, they did call, the hospital. They got her to the hospital where she did pass away.
For other families, there's ongoing hardship in terms of storm damage. In episode two, you introduce Sandra Edwards, who lives in Houston. She was still dealing with damage to her home from Hurricane Harvey in 2017 when the grid failure happened more than 3 years later, and it was like just another sucker punch.
I mean, she's not the only one I've heard of in this situation as well, out in the Gulf Coast. I mean, we have had just a barrage of huge natural disasters, met with many would argue like insufficient response and help from our state, and so Sandra is among those who is still suffering from Hurricane Harvey damage. For a variety of reasons, her home has not been fully repaired from that. If you are in a house that that was not built or had damage to it that so that it could not sustain these kinds of freezing temperatures, well, then you were in even much worse circumstances when the freeze hit and your power was cut, which is where she found herself. So she is struggling now with the impacts of all of that, the blackout, the freeze, and the hurricane. Interestingly enough, we talked to her for our episode that looks at energy bills, because regardless of whether or not even if your power was cut, regardless of whether or not you even lost power in the blackout, you are probably noticing that you're paying higher bills. Sandra is a woman who is dealing with all of these huge problems to her property and her life as a result of all of this, and then also looks at her bill every month and sees how high it is. And asks, what am I paying for? Why am I paying even more now since this disaster if I'm still suffering from the consequences of it? And that's something that we get into in the second episode. Why are our bills higher? All the different kinds of places where we've seen increases since the blackout.
So in our house, we got the highest electric bill we had ever seen last month, and it has been really hot. At first, we figured that we just had to use so much energy keeping the house around 80 degrees. But it turns out it isn't just most Texans have been using more electricity to cope with this extra hot summer. There's more to these bills than that.
Absolutely. And you are correct. One of the main drivers is probably energy use because of this wild heat that we've been experiencing. But there's more. Another huge factor in this are natural gas prices. Obviously, global events and other things have brought natural gas prices really, really high beginning earlier this year. And that's meant huge profits for natural gas companies, but it all translates on your bill into higher energy prices. Natural gas, of course, is a prime fuel to generate electricity in Texas. So that's how those two things are related. And then beyond that, we have tons of other reasons why our bills are higher. We have costs that were incurred during the blackout and winter storm. If you recall, electricity prices were pushed to their highest legally allowed level for days and days during that storm. And the state had to figure out a kind of creative way of paying all that debt off, essentially by pushing it back towards the consumers where Texas electric ratepayers will be paying off those billions of dollars in debt over the course of decades in order to pay down that note. And we also have, which many of your listeners have probably heard about, the reforms that have already kind of taken place, the overhaul, I should say, of the Texas energy market that our state regulators have undertaken after direction from state lawmakers. Those reforms, which I'm sure we'll get into, are also increasing our bills.
Yep, Mose, one of the things I really like about your work is that you're very good at taking this very complicated material and breaking it down for us step by step. So I want to do that with you here. Generally speaking, in Texas, our bills include money paid out to a number of different entities. Let's start with the retail electric provider or REP. The REP is the company that like sends us our bill, right? The ones we think of as providing our energy, but REPs are not actually direct power suppliers.
Yeah, and it is really all depends on where you live in Texas. In parts of like where I am in Austin, we have a city-owned utility. It's a publicly owned utility, Austin Energy. In other parts where they fully deregulated the retail electric market, they, not to get too wonky about it, but you have these things called REPs, retail electric providers. They are companies that will buy electricity generally off and off from ERCOT, and then sell it to a consumer, at a profit, presumably, kind of middlemen. They're like, energy brokers that compete with each other to offer the most competitive electricity plan to consumers in a deregulated area.
Is ERCOT the only entity in the state that buys physical electricity for distribution to these reps?
No, and this is where things get complicated really quickly. ERCOT is the main kind of energy market for the state grid, for day ahead contracts. But if you want to look further out, there are other ways where you can buy energy contracts that are much further removed from, you could say, official control. ERCOT, of course, occupies a very nebulous space already here in Texas. Technically, it's a nonprofit that is not, it's you know, kind of not governmental, quasi-governmental, you often hear people say, but it is, of course, overseen by the state's Public Utility Commission. So while ERCOT may claim certain kind of privileges that non-public entities claim, it is an organization that is overseen by the state of Texas. Outside of that, you can buy energy contracts on futures markets, on different markets. There's the Intercontinental Exchange Market, which is a big one, where people can trade energy contracts and speculate on energy prices that are independent of the ERCOT market. And that, of course, is also a place where people take and make money and buy and sell electricity.
So ERCOT is a nonprofit and it is sort of middleman to the middlemen, but it's also taking a cut, right? I mean, our bills also reflect some money that gets paid out to ERCOT for this service.
You started this with the retail electric provider. So we'll start there. You have a retail electric provider, or in some cases, maybe a public utility. They are going to take some money to either as profit if they're a rep or otherwise. And then they will say, if they get their energy off the ERCOT market, ERCOT is going to take some money in order to continue operating. I mean, if you remember, ERCOT is not simply a market, right? It is the air traffic controller of the Texas grid. ERCOT is the organization that maintains the flow of energy around the state, and that takes a lot of money to do. So obviously, they need to make that money somehow, and they can make it by taking their cut in these transactions.
So one level back, Mose, from ERCOT, we have electricity generators because ERCOT itself also doesn't produce a single watt of energy. Is that correct?
An important point, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people they became familiar with ERCOT in the context of the blackout. And yeah, I probably can't repeat enough that this is a group that doesn't really own any of the actual physical stuff, of the Texas power grid. Not transmission, not power plants. They have some authority over it, but they don't own it. They're going to get the power that they kind of distribute and manage on the grid. They're going to get that from energy generators. Increasingly, it's renewable, but still, primarily, like the biggest part of our energy generation in Texas is still natural gas power plants, and more generally what they call thermal power plants. That'd be coal, nuclear, and gas.
Okay, so we've got coal, nuclear, gas, solar, and wind. Do all these generators get to charge the same amount per kilowatt for energy they sell, regardless of what it costs them to make?
Yeah, I mean, this is a competitive market, right? So they essentially bid in to the ERCOT market, and ERCOT's job traditionally has been to take the lowest bid. Not to get too in the weeds here, but this is where you get a lot of kind of complaining and bickering between fossil fuel advocates and renewable and the emerging renewable sector, because they claim each sector has its own kinds of help in terms of incentivizing them to offer lower. But anyway, it's a competitive market. You're supposed to generate electricity, bid in at the lowest, and that's how it gets on the grid.
Okay, so all these entities are part of the bills that we have that we feel like are much too high at the moment. I do have to ask, though, Mose, Is this system so different from, say, you know, we might buy a bag of frozen corn from Target. They have to buy it from Birds Eye. Birds Eye has to buy the corn from suppliers. Is this somehow fundamentally different than that sort of supply chain?
You know, I don't know that it would be, honestly. I mean, you've created a competitive market. The difference in Texas, in large measure, is the way that we have what they call an energy only market. So I want to try to kind of follow your analogy a little bit. In other states, let me just I'll set it up like this. In other states, the energy system pays energy generators to be available to supply electricity when needed. The way that Texas set up its energy market when we deregulated about 20 years ago was to say we are only going to pay energy suppliers for the power that they can sell on the grid, like on, you know, on ERCOT. And so that power price is going to be the prime driver in terms of how much energy generation is built in the states and are the kind of capacity for our entire grid system. And the argument for that is that it would create such a highly competitive environment that it would be ultra efficient. We wouldn't have power plants sitting around that we didn't need. To a large degree, it succeeded in that. We had a very like small margin of extra energy capacity in the state by the time we got around to the blackout last year. The downside, of course, is that you really don't have a very good cushion of electricity to support you if you start running low. And to take it even a step further, the entire system is run on energy scarcity. The idea is that the price of electricity gets higher, the less electricity is available. And once you suffer from a blackout like we suffered from last year, you begin thinking maybe that's not such a good idea. Maybe we need a little extra. So to loop back to your analogy, it could be a system like the market system you're describing, but one that if that was to happen with food in a crisis, if you were to start seeing corn, for example, skyrocket in price at that market you're referring to when people are starting to starve, that would be considered illegal, right? That would be considered price gouging.
Right. Here's something I did not know, Mose, which is that some retail electric providers or reps dealing directly with customers, they are affiliated with electricity generators. Does that make
Right.
things any cheaper for us? Does it amount to double dipping? What is that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I mean, the one thing that we can say for sure is that it seems to cut against the entire purpose of deregulation. And again, like without getting too in the weeds, the whole idea of deregulation in the state of Texas, because we used to have, you know, what you would consider to be the traditional setup, right? Monopoly utilities. This was the electric company. It was the big electric company generated power. It owned the transmission lines, and you also paid your bill to that same company. And it was the only game in town. You couldn't shop around. And so when they deregulated, they said that is the people that. You know, people that like that model, they'll say, well, it's a vertically integrated utility, and you know, it's stable and it's there to provide you steady electricity. People that don't like that model, they'll use a different term for it. They'll say it's a monopoly utility. It has a stranglehold on your business. We want to break up that monopoly and force it to compete to provide consumers better prices. So that's what they did. About 20 years ago, they break up these big power companies in most parts of the state. They take the transmission part that's its own company. They take the power generation part that's its own company. They take the retail part, and suddenly that becomes these retail electric providers that we're talking about. What you're referring to is a gradual, and sometimes not so gradual, reconsolidation of the retail part with the larger generation part. And essentially, what's happened is that big power companies that generate power now, if you kind of go far enough up the corporate structure, you see that the same parent company controls the generation part of that and the retail part. And that clearly, you know, cuts against the idea of breaking up these utilities. Now, whether that, you know, is kind of re the reconstitution of a monopoly that can exercise undue market power, you know, I need to do more reporting on that, but that is the criticism, and that's certainly the fear.
Okay, we have lots of people calling in with questions. I want to get to those in just a moment, but I do want to ask you about, you mentioned this thing called the Intercontinental Exchange, also known as ICE. What is that?
Well, it's just another market where you can buy and sell energy contracts, or kind of trade energy almost as a, you can speculate, you can speculate on the price of energy. So if you think that ERCOT is misjudging how much electricity is going to cost tomorrow, you could go on ICE and bet against ERCOT and try to pull some profit from that bet, or vice versa. And basically these markets also they constitute, people go to them for a lot of different reasons. One of them is to speculate. There are other reasons too.
Okay. To the phones, our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up is Thomas in Bella Vista, Arkansas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to first say thank you so much for talking about this. This has been on my mind since it happened. And I actually used to live in Dallas, and I moved because of this. My question is this, in all the reporting and the research through this podcast, and thank you so much for doing this, by the way, sir. What are politicians saying behind the scenes? What are state representatives saying behind the scenes, the ones that are supposed to be touting capitalism and the deregulated market in Texas, as supposed to be the most efficient and reliable way to do all business, including electricity distribution? And yet it seems like to be nothing but a logistical nightmare. It seems to be totally reversed to their theory. It's such a mess. And I'm like, when are they going to wake up and see that they're living kind of a hypocritical nightmare?
Thomas, thanks for your call. What do you know about what lawmakers are thinking, Mose?
Well, I mean, I don't know what they're thinking, but I can say that after the blackout, which a lot of people did see as a complete indictment, of the system that had been set up, the state and our state leadership moved pretty quickly to shore it up, rather than reimagine it, which I think gets to the kind of the heart of Thomas's question, right? The proposals were never to recreate our market system in Texas. All the things that we saw happen were aimed at salvaging it, and then after it was salvaged, which it had to be salvaged because it was literally brought to the brink of collapse in the financial crisis that accompanied the blackout crisis. After it was salvaged, to kind of shore it up and try to make it more reliable, which is what we've seen now, in the last year and a half, is kind of like, I've been trying to toy with this analogy lately, but like if the market is like think of the grid as a computer, right? The market is like the software that it's running on. They're not getting it. They don't want to put in a new operating system. They wanted to maybe put in some updates to the software. And that's a lot of what you see reported on now, these market tweaks and reforms that seem to be such a big deal, I guess you could say, for state regulators, but that seem so mystifying for your average consumer. That's what they're doing. They're trying to change the way the market works in little ways, all the while saying we are not changing the fundamentals. And almost every lawmaker that you hear in a position of power talk about this insists we're not changing the underlying structure of this market. We're not changing the operating system. What we're going to do is just improve it, do some updates, and then you won't have to worry anymore.
Why not change the operating system? Why is that objectionable to them?
A lot of people still really believe that this offers perhaps the most efficient way of running things. You also have, when you create a system in which so many different sectors of the economy draw profit, I think it becomes really difficult, right? I mean, like, one thing that you do when you start explaining the way these systems work is seeing how many different sectors of the economy rely, at least in part, on things to keep running the way they're running. And all of those sectors, and we try to lay this out in our most recent episode, all those different kind of corporate corporations or different parts of the economy, different industries, whether it's the fossil fuel industry or the power generation industry, they all understand the rules right now and are made less comfortable by changing the entire rules than they would be by, maybe fighting within the confines of these rules to see if they can get a bigger cut of the pie.
All right, Mose, why is March 11th, 2021 such an important date with this story?
That was interesting. This is a whole part of this story that we really wanted to get into last year, but it was so much that we had to wait until this season to get into it. If you remember, and so much was going on during and after the blackout that it would be easy to forget. But the blackout hits Texas, and our state regulators, because of this market system we're discussing, they do really the only thing that they can do. They say, we don't have enough electricity on the grid, so let's make it super duper expensive as we can possibly make it. Because surely, if it's really expensive, well, that means more people will somehow start generating and putting it on the grid. I'm oversimplifying a little, but not too much. This was the approach that the Public Utility Commission of Texas, along with ERCOT, enacted by ERCOT, the Public Utility Commission approved this approach. ERCOT implements the approach. And so for the so most of the blackout, not only were people suffering without power, but they were kind of counterintuitively paying higher costs for power than they had ever paid before. After that filtered down, and it was made clear that this had created a huge financial crisis in Texas, state lawmakers got together on that date, March 11th, that you referred to discuss what to do about it. This is in the state Senate, and again, most people have probably forgotten about this, but there was a proposal called repricing, and essentially what this would have done is go back and lower those bills for a duration of the blackout, lower the cost of electricity because it had been a mistake. It had been, as some people call it, an overcharge. And Texas state lawmakers, many of them saw this as their responsibility and their right by virtue of the fact that this is the Texas grid. You know what I mean? Like this we're the only state with our own grid, and so we have perhaps this kind of greater freedom to kind of make the rules or remake them, in the interests of consumers. March 11th, this hearing was held at the state Senate. Repricing was addressed, and there was a lot of compelling testimony around this that we feature in our most recent episode. But of course, at the end of the day, that did not happen. I mean, you can argue whether that's good or not, but the fact is that repricing became too complicated and too much of, I think, a threat as well to groups that had made a lot of money in the blackout. And once it became clear that for everyone who might be helped by repricing, someone else is going to lose some of their profit, then the political calculus becomes much more difficult. And if you recall, I think the most famous incident that happened here was that the man who was then chair of the Public Utility Commission was heard on tape. There's a tape that was leaked where he was talking to investment analysts from Bank of America about how much he was fighting against repricing. These, you know, spe and I should mention Texas Monthly is the outlet that broke this story. He heard on tape, assuring them he was doing everything in his power to fight this repricing effort, talking to these same people, these same groups, I should say, who had tons and tons of money in the blackout and stood to lose it if this repricing had gone forward.
It is interesting, though, because that incentive, I mean, it makes sense in ordinary times. If you allow people to charge more, they'll make more. But this was an emergency situation when we didn't have the capacity to produce more at that moment.
Yeah, that was the real head scratcher about all that. There's no the power plants and natural gas systems weren't working. So, it's not as though spiking the price was going to bring a lot more generation online. You could argue, and people at ERCOT did, that high energy prices also encourage conservation. So, if you're a large industrial user and you see the prices that high, you're not going to start running your factories again. And so, that may have helped. And somehow on the margins to stabilize the grid, because it's not all about supply, it's also about demand. So, it gets a little more complicated, but you're exactly correct. There weren't the power plants there to make extra energy at that time.
Mose, if my business is operating an ice cream truck and my ice cream truck needs a new engine, I have a couple of options. I can start charging, you know, a quarter more for every popsicle I sell to my customers, or I can, you know, take a slightly smaller profit for the season. Are Texas ratepayers in effect being charged for fixing the ice cream truck?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you're talking, and I lost connection for a second there, but if you're talking about the costs incurred during the blackout, we are all paying down those costs, and we are also paying extra to try to fix the truck. Sure. yeah. We're paying more now ever since the blackout, thanks to the overhaul of the system that has been enacted in order to try to create a more reliable Texas grid. Now, whether it's accomplished that is another question, but we're paying more to try to do that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Again, the number is 800-933-5372. Rachel is on the line in Rowlett. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I moved here about 2 years ago, right before this dreaded blackout, of course. And I've lived in a bunch of states, but most recently California, where there's really only one electricity provider, that's PG&E. And so I was a little confused when I moved here and my realtor explained our deregulated system, and I was selecting an electricity provider, but really I was just selecting electricity retailer, right, when I was signing up for electricity. I still don't understand how they can justify it being called, or justify saying it's deregulating the monopolized system. There's still a finite number of electricity providers in the state, right? And these retailers, like, their rates aren't all that different. It doesn't seem all that competitive to me at all. I just don't understand, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but I've just never understood this concept since we've lived here.
Thanks for your call, Rachel.
I mean, it's a very confusing concept, and like I said, it's not like this in all of the state. There are still places, rural co-ops offer a different model for how people can get their electricity, as do city or municipally owned utilities. But yeah, the argument was that competition would lead to lower prices for consumers. That's kind of the standard argument for competitive markets. The reality is, I think, much more nuanced there. There are different studies that people point to. If you're a fan of this system, you can have your studies you point to that say that it has brought lower electricity bills to some people in the deregulated retail space. But there are plenty of studies that show that actually people's bills are higher in the deregulated retail space because they don't always avail themselves of those very low prices. So basically, if you want to be the kind of person that constantly monitors the internet for the best deal in town and then always jumps on it in the time frame that you're offered, and it is always like kind of turning this into a part-time job, yeah, maybe you could benefit from it. But most people, I would argue, would prefer to just be able to know that their lights are going to come on and they're being offered a relatively fair rate for that. And in the regulated system that you were describing, that was much more the purview of the state, right? You know, your public utility commission would have a much larger role in making sure that people didn't get fleeced, I guess.
To go back for a minute to this decision not to retroactively lower the price on that incredibly expensive energy that some Texans were sold during the height of the blackout, I just want to get something straight. Did that amount to a ratepayer-funded bailout for the energy industry, or did it prevent the need for a bailout?
It depends on who you ask. You know, I had a conversation with the current chair of the Public Utility Commission, where I described it as making these companies and utilities whole again. These are the companies that were at the brink of or over the brink of bankruptcy. And I should mention some of them public. I mean, like the biggest one was a rural co-op. So these weren't all the retail electric providers that we were talking about earlier or anything else. These were all sorts of different companies all along that work in this market that found themselves on the wrong end of these super high prices. The effort to reprice or then later to pay off this debt was essentially an effort to make these entities whole again. And And he very, you know, was very strident saying, you cannot call this a bailout. You can't call it a bailout. I actually never even called it a bailout in that interview. It's clearly a sore spot for people who favored this approach, that it was not a bailout. But, you know, I don't see, I don't really see the distinction. The market was about to fall off a cliff. A bunch of companies were in big trouble. There was one option put on the table that might have helped, might have, you know, repricing. I'm not here advocating that option. It's just an interesting, you know, example. That option was not taken. So instead, all of this debt was securitized. It was put in little tiny amounts on people's bills for decades so they could restabilize the market. I mean, is that better? Is restabilize different from a bailout? I don't really think so.
Okay, so you and I've mostly been talking about what happens in the first two episodes of season two of your podcast, The Disconnect. But upcoming episodes will deal with what has been changed, like physically, that might help prevent another catastrophic grid failure in Texas. Can you give us some highlights?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, like I said, there's like there's the software, and then there's the hardware. And the thing that's easiest, I think, for people to wrap their heads around is the hardware. Basically, a bunch of stuff froze and broke down in February 2021, and that's one of the main reasons that we lost power. And so, what you got to do is make sure that doesn't happen again. That's improving the infrastructure, the hardware of things. Shortly after the blackout, the Public Utility Commission of Texas did what it did not do during the previous blackout, which was create hard mandates on weatherizing power plants. So by the fall of 2021, power generators had to meet certain standards so that they could operate in certain amounts of cold weather. Now, that's a tangible thing that, you know, that they could point to and say, we did this, and this is what something that Texas is not well known for wanting to do, but this is a regulation, this is a mandate that we're putting on these companies to do this. So that's one thing that did happen. There is currently still work being done on the natural gas side, because the natural gas supply infrastructure also broke down. It's taken a lot longer for them to create regulations and mandates at the Railroad Commission of Texas, which regulates oil and gas in the state. But they just recently finished getting public input on their proposal to weatherize natural gas infrastructure. So by this coming winter, we're supposed to see some rules around that. They've also done some work to identify critical infrastructure that should not have its power cut. If you remember during the blackout, there was these episodes of natural gas suppliers and pipeline you know systems saying that they couldn't move natural gas because their power had been cut in the power cuts, right? So it's like you couldn't, that part of the reason power plants couldn't work is because they weren't getting fuel. Part of the reason they weren't getting fuel is because of the blackout. Part of the reason for the blackout is because the power plants can't work. So that is another place where regulators have stepped in and started trying to create a kind of list, if you will, of places where you can't cut power, and also you've got to keep being able to run in the case of these types of extreme weather events. Whether they're doing a good job of accounting for climate change when they consider extreme weather is a whole other question. A lot of people say that we still have our head in the sand around what type of extreme weather we might expect with the ongoing climate crisis.
Oh, I see. So we might need to assume that what feels extreme in 2022 will be just another year by 2050.
I think that this summer is a great example of that, and I hate to say this, but you know, if you look at the models, we are. This summer feels really hot right now. It's not the hottest we've had, but it feels really, really hot. A summer like this may feel much closer to normal, much sooner than any of us want to think.
Okay, back to the phones. Once again, Steve is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yeah, I had one comment, but a question. Isn't it odd? Luckily, I had fixed rate, that you didn't have electricity yet. Your rates were really, really high. You had a high bill, but that. I understand. It just sounds funny when you think about that paradox. Anyway, my question was, what happens when we all say gosh, it's a great idea. We should all have electric cars. What could possibly go wrong?
Huh?
And the...
What do you think about the hazards of that, Mose, knowing what we know about the reliability of our electrical system?
I mean, I think it's a really great question. It's something you hear a lot of people talking about right now. The potential, for me, a lot of this goes back to climate change. I know that we haven't talked about it a lot, but the challenge of addressing climate change requires us to electrify and to get off burning fossil fuels in large measure. And so, you know, if you take that as a given, which I know a lot of people don't, it will mean more electric cars. To have all those cars plugged in all at the same time, drawing more power from the grid under our current system would create more strain on the grid. Sure. People that advocate for electric vehicles, they say, but wait, you know, if you start looking at these cars as batteries that could feed back into the grid in a time of scarcity, well, then maybe you can start looking at them as a benefit. But either way you look at it, it's going to require changing the way things are set up right now. You're going to have to change our system to account for these new technologies. And the question is whether we're doing that adequately. And the technologies are changing so quickly, it almost seems sometimes like a really tall order. I mean, like, it's hard to conceive of how much the grid has changed in the last 10, 15 years with renewable energy coming on and so much else changing in the state of Texas. So to think ahead another 10, 15 years is a really difficult thing to do, to try to be able to prepare for that.
Some people have said it might be time for Texas to think seriously about connecting to other grids beyond the state network in a more meaningful way. What would the potential pros and cons be of this?
I'll start with the cons, because there's obviously a reason we haven't done that yet. And one of the big reasons is regulatory. Right now, because we don't have many connections with other states, with other grids, we really can kind of run our own show. Again, our inability to, I think the blackouts show the limits of that, because we still operate within the larger economy and the whole larger financial system, but we still can kind of avoid federal regulations by having our own grid. That's the main reason we haven't done it, it seems to me. So some of the benefits could include economic benefits. We have a ton of wind generation and just a ton of energy generation in the state right now that we don't usually always need. So if you have the capacity to make power, let's take a wind farm in West Texas, but nobody needs that electricity right now. If we had greater connections with other parts of the country, we could be selling that elsewhere, right? I mean, it could be a huge business opportunity. Likewise, when we're scarce on energy, when we're short, wouldn't it be nice to be able to pull from a neighboring grid if it's available from that grid, especially for short amounts of time? I mean, we remember the blackout as this days long event, but typically, you know, our scarcity lasts the amount of time it gets people to kind of get home from work, turn their lights on, and then eventually kind of go to bed at night. These things don't typically last more than a few hours. So in those short time frames, connecting to neighboring grids could really make a huge difference. It's something that on a large scale, though, is just not, doesn't seem to be on the table right now with our leadership.
Very quickly, any sense of how long we'll be paying off the damage from last winter?
Paying off the damage, paying off the debt. A lot of the ways that they handle that debt, you know, could look 20, 30 years out into the future. So just kind of small little, you know, extra payments that ratepayers do for decades and decades to come.
Mose Bushell is a reporter at KUT and host of the podcast The Disconnect: Power, Politics, and the Texas Blackout. Season 2 is out now. Mose, it's always so nice to talk with you. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for KERA Think. You can find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.